Creative in your answers. The future belongs to those who dream big. The survey may be found at www.wpfwfm.org. Please submit your answers by June 30th. Thank you for your thoughts and time.
Hi, I'm Danny Glover, and you are tuned into WPFW Washington, your station for jazz and justice.
This is a journey.
Would you join me, please, in welcoming
me? Redeemer, full of college.
I got so much trouble on my mind. Refuse to lose. Here's your ticket.
Amazing.
I didn't know nothing about it.
I don't want to be like Mike.
Say what you say, say what?
I don't want to be like Mike.
Before Magic's knees go permanently south for the winter.
I don't want to be like Mike.
Changing up the guard quicker than fear brings down doo-doo. Bro.
He never saw Elgin Baylor play during his day or Oscar Robinson.
Flash the dice roll back. The big O was jackknifing through all them bodies.
I didn't know nothing about it.
Welcome to The Collision, where sports and politics collide here at your home for jazz and justice on WPFW in Washington, D.C., and also on WBAI in New York City. I'm your co-host, Chuck Modiano, and the bad news is co-host Dave Zirin will not be with us today. Co-host Aton Thomas will not be with us today. That's the bad news. The good news is, and I had been mentioning this, we will have Jackie Lupmon with us today, and we're going to tackle some things like making sense of Trump and Iran, what is actually going on. We're going to clarify that with Jackie. We're also going to talk about, you might have heard, there's an election in New York City that happened, and make sense of that. What does that mean? What does that not mean? What is that looking like? And we're going to talk about a few topics with Jackie. On the back end of the show, we're going to get into some sports. You might have heard there was a draft last night. There's a lot in the NBA, the Oklahoma City, the Thunder. They won the championship. Some people are talking about they could be a dynasty. You might have heard Kevin Durant was traded to Houston. There's a lot to talk about there. And the NBA draft, Cooper Flagg was your number one pick. And unlike a lot of people who are hyped, particularly white American players who are hyped, I think Cooper might be the real deal. Not just hype, but the real deal. He has an incredible game. And a lot of that discussion, the NBA draft discussion, we're going to take on next week. So I don't really want to get deep into that without Aton here, without DZ here. And we're going to get into that. But we're also going to talk about on the back end the WNBA, and particularly Natasha Cloud. We touched upon Natasha Cloud last week. We're going to talk about Natasha Cloud's history of activism and why she and other women who do some amazing activism and are very outspoken, we don't hear about them in the general conversation about athlete activists. They don't get the love. They don't get the due. So here's what's going on right now. But I do want to start with Jack. Jack, are you here? So, she's not unmuted. Okay. So while Jackie gets unmuted, Jackie is here, but she's gonna have. There we go. So Jackie is here. Jackie, is that you? We're gonna figure that out because Jackie's here and I see she's here, but we're gonna figure out the tech issues. And in the meantime, let me just tell you a little about Jackie Lupon. If you're WPFW, do I hear you? Jackie? We did for a second. So we're gonna get it together. And as we get it together, you should already know Jackie Lupon. Because if you know Darker Than Blue, that's 5 p.m. on Fridays, right here at WPFW. If you're not already listening to Darker Than Blue, you should. And you're going to probably get a sample of why you should. Because Jackie Lupon, she co-hosts the show Darker Than Blue and is really giving it to you every week on WPFW, again, at Friday at 5 p.m. She is also on the weekly Black Power Media show, Lupon Nation. She is also the organizer for the Mid-Atlantic region of Black Alliance for Peace and is an organizer with the Pan-African Community Action here in D.C., PACA. Besides all that, Jacqueline is a moderator and member of the Board of Social Action of the Plymouth Congregational United Church of Christ right here in Washington, D.C. And I'm going to throw a lot of people in WPFW family know that. So I'm going to throw a wrinkle in there. And you didn't know, and I hope I'm not using the word too strong, that Jackie's almost kind of a metalhead as well. And a lot of people maybe don't see that coming. And maybe we'll talk about that as well. Are you with us, Jackie?
I am. And I'm not almost a metalhead, Chuck. I am a metalhead.
You are a metalhead. Okay. That's a heavy title. That means you got to know your stuff the way you know your politics.
I mean, I admit that I don't listen to a lot of the current stuff, and they're not even current anymore because they're not even together anymore, I don't think. I mean, I think probably the most up-to-date metal I've probably listened to is like Mudvayne and Slipknot, probably. Mm-hmm. But, you know, other than that, it's, you know, the Metallica era and everything in between those two. I'm an old school metalhead.
So. You're an old school metalhead. When did you start getting into metal?
Oh, high school. Yeah. High school. Yeah. I heard Heart for the first time. And
wow, Heart's one of my favorite bands.
Yeah. And I was like, what? Women?
Yeah.
And you know, that's kind of how I started kind of listening to different stuff. But I've always liked different kinds of music. I've always been really curious about different kinds of music. So yeah. I would, and I listened to stations like WOL and then WPFW and listened to different music from different countries, different cultures. And I'm just curious about how different people express themselves through music. And believe it or not, I know people think it's weird, but you know, punk and metal are extremely emotionally expressive kinds of genres. And you know, I think for these times in particular, they're pretty appropriate.
Right, right. Right. So you'd say Heart was like your hard rock guitar entry point that led you toward the Metallica and more. Was that fair to say?
Yeah, I think when I was in high school and I listened to Heart, I got into like the big arena bands.
Yeah.
You know, because I listened to DC 101 at the time and that's what they were playing. And then when I graduated high school, I dated Fred Smith, who's the guitar player for Beefeater and then Strange Boutique, the very, very big punk bands in DC. So I was a punk for a while. And punk led me to metal in particular.
Right.
So, you know, as a punk, I got exposed to Bad Brains and Scream,
and
you know, Government Issue and 7 Seconds and you know, all of that, Discord Records and all of that great stuff. And the energy in punk I really liked. And then when metal came along, it was like, this is even more fun because, right. You know, I'm not gonna break my neck in the pit necessarily.
Right, right. Oh, you know what? If I could be a fly on the mosh pit to see you in there, I what I would give to see that, but it's not gonna happen. But
No, not these days.
Not these days. You're a little slowed down, but not too slowed down, and people will see that you are not. So I could go another half hour on metal because it falls within our popular culture and sports. But there's still a lot of stuff that's going on in the world today, and we want to help make sense of what is going on, and whether that is the election in New York City or Trump and Iran going back and forth. And let's just start right there. We're trying to make sense of what is happening. What is Trump doing, not doing in relation to Israel and in relation to Iran? Is there a war? Is it stopped? Can you make sense a little bit of what is happening for those who haven't been paying attention? Because I know you have.
I mean, what happened was that Iran exercised its right to defend itself against attacks, an unprovoked attack from Israel.
Unprovoked.
I'm sorry?
No, unprovoked. We don't hear that in the media, that part.
Yeah. Unprovoked. It wasn't preemptive. Preemptive of what? The preemptive thing is Israel's line against it on, and it has always been Israel's line against it on, because Israel has accused it on of being weeks and months away from building a nuclear weapon for decades. So that's where this whole preemptive strike foolishness comes from. Yeah. The accusation that Iran is building a weapon, and the assumption is, the argument is, that if Iran is allowed to build a nuclear weapon, the first thing that Iran is going to do is shoot it at Israel. That is the argument. And there's no logic behind the argument. There are no facts behind that claim. There is no evidence behind that accusation. It is the delusional white supremacist Zionist lie that Israel has cooked up in order to justify their attacks against Iran for years. So the latest attack, unprovoked attack by Israel against Iran, is a part of that. And it's a part of Israel's continuing expansion in the region of illegally occupying parts of land in countries that neighbor Palestine. And the U.S. response is, of course, to support Israel in that. But Trump is, it's a weird situation. Well, because first of all, people who voted for Trump because he said he's the anti-war candidate, and people believed him. I don't understand why people continue to believe anything this man says. Yeah. When he said, "I'm going to take 2 weeks to make a decision," everybody should have known that was a lie. Yeah. Because the next day, what did he do? So, and then there are people who are saying, well, if we had voted for Kamala Harris, this wouldn't have happened. No, Kamala Harris said that Iran is the greatest threat to America. And Iran has done nothing to America.
And you're referring to the 60 Minutes interview.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes. And she said to an audience of Jewish voters, most of whom were Zionists, that under her presidency, she would deal with Iran. She would make sure that Iran would never get a nuclear weapon to threaten Israel with. And she said to them, all options are on the table.
Yeah.
In U.S. speak, that means we will bomb them. That is an option that is valid that we will use. So if people are thinking that Kamala Harris would not have bombed Iran or would not have supported the bombing of Iran by Israel, it might not have happened this quickly, but it absolutely would have happened, because she would have continued to support the genocide that Israel is carrying out, because she supported it the whole last 20 months. And she has already said that Iran is the enemy, that we have the option to bomb them on the table to deal with force. So people are very confused about Trump being the unique character that is maneuvering all of this. No, it is the system in this country. Mm. It's the duopoly. It's the Democrats and the Republicans who are supporting Israel in their genocidal actions against Palestinians and in their wider genocidal and internationally criminal actions against the sovereign nation surrounding them, who are many of whom are in solidarity with Palestine. Not all of them, because there is Egypt and there is Jordan, and they signed the Abraham Accords.
That's right.
Right? So this is why Iran is not bothering them.
Right.
Iran is attacking, this is why Israel is not bothering them. Israel is attacking Iran because Iran did not sign the Abraham Accords, and Iran is in support of the resistance in the of the Palestinian people.
That's
so
right.
This response by Iran was measured. It was controlled. Some people are saying because of the way Iran did it, they did call Trump and tell him, you know, we have to respond, but we are not going to kill a bunch of people. So this is when we're going to bomb this base.
Yeah.
Make sure there are no people there.
Okay.
Because we are going to bomb the base. We're just not going to kill a bunch of people like y'all psychopaths. So
people he's looking for a symbolic victory. Was he looking like for a symbolic victory?
Well, I think, like I said, I think Iran was exercising their right to defend themselves. But unlike the imperialists and the settler colonialists and the Zionists, the U.S. and NATO and Israel, they don't feel a need to kill a bunch of people to make a point.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. Now, did they have an absolute right to respond in kind with the way Israel bombed them? Yes, they did. Absolutely. But as much as I don't entirely agree with the way Iran carried this out, because if it were me, I wouldn't have called and warned anybody. But this is why I'm not the leader of anybody's country.
So. Right. Right.
But
I see what you're saying. Go ahead.
I respect Iran's effort to make the point that we have a right to defend ourselves, and we will, but we are not going to take needless lives to do it, because we don't have to. Yeah. Because we understand, and I think Iran understood, that if they had just bombed the base and killed a bunch of American personnel and military, then that would have been grounds for the U.S. to do worse, to get directly involved and do worse.
That's
so.
Right.
I understand people being dissatisfied with the way that Iran exercised their right to defend themselves. But I argue that I believe they did it this way to preserve as much life as they could while they make their point, while they exercise their right to defend themselves. But also keeping in mind that reducing the loss of life would not escalate this to an all-out regional conflict that the U.S. is now directly involved in. You see what I mean?
Yeah, I do. And you know, you mentioned a lot of interesting points in there and myth-making from both people who, some maybe some anti-war activists who thought Trump would be an anti-war candidate because he said something and there was revisionist history. And also on the side of revisionist history for those people who were saying, if you voted for Kamala, none of this would happen. And what's interesting about both these situations is that in each camp, the record has been pretty clear. Donald Trump had 4 years. There was a Trump one. And mm-hmm. at times he was bombing on unprecedented levels. He bombed Yemen more than all the previous presidents combined. He had a record over 7,000 bombs dropped in Afghanistan in 2019. There was no history of Trump being anti-war in any way, shape, or form. And yet there was a slice. I don't know how big the segment is, but you and I have both dealt with it within the anti-war community who say, yeah, I think Trump will be a pacifist because he said a couple of political things. And I'm like, when we have this record, why does that happen? You could look at that record. And then on the other hand, as you pointed out, I'm hearing in the last week that, you know, none of this would have happened if Kamala was president. When, yeah, she said Iran was the number one adversary, and wasn't prompted, by the way. Didn't say China, didn't say Russia, mentioned that. You had Tim Walz, who had talked about expansion of Israel. Some said the flub. I think the only flub was that he said it out loud. And then you have some Israeli leaders who were mentioning, I believe, that crazy rabbi Mizrachi was talking about that we didn't move forward on Iran because we wanted to wait till after the election and Kamala was elected. There are a lot of other pieces here within this, troops being sent by Biden. So when we have all this evidence, and for both camps, people defending Trump and people defending Kamala, why are people creating these myths when we have a record of history that says the opposite? Why is that happening?
I think people are probably emotionally fatigued from all of the chaos, from realizing that everything they were told about this country being free and equal and just and you know, doing being a force for good in the world and everyone having equal access to opportunity here, people are realizing that's not true. And that's very, you know, having your worldview smashed, basically, that can be very difficult for people. And people are kind of weary and wary dealing with the fact that the reality they thought they lived in is not true. But people also are very wary of what they don't know, right? What we've all been told about revolutionary change, about socialism, people still believe these things. So the alternative to this capitalist imperialist system is socialism. And people still, although they recognize that this system is not what they were told it is not fair, it is not just, it is not equal. A very small number of people control all of the resources, and we are all fighting over a small piece of what's left. As much as people hate that, it seems to me that people are more afraid of fighting for the option, the alternative. And the alternative is socialism for humanity, because people still believe in the ways that this system has indoctrinated us against socialism and socialist countries and socialist leaders. A lot of people still believe the empire. They still believe that if they just tweak the system a little bit and make it better, then we'll be okay. And they do not want to believe, even though they know that the system is not what they have been told it is, they don't want to believe that it can't be saved. That's, I think, what it really is. They want to try to save the system. They don't want to try anything, quote unquote, new to them, because the alternative, socialism, has been demonized so much. And they still have faith in some of what this system says. I think a lot of people still have faith in the inherent goodness of the idea of the system. They just think that some of the people have messed it up. And if we just switch out some of the people, the system will be better. And we know that is not how this is, that's not going to make things better at all.
That's right. You know, this might be a perfect segue to talk about what's the election in New York this week. Bye-bye, Andrew Cuomo, raging Zionist. And 15 other things. I could go down a list with Andrew Cuomo, who had shown a lot of, I don't know, chutzpah, let's just say, to even run for mayor. I mean, there's some people that just have no shame. And
yeah,
he's got no, I mean, this man has no shame, Andrew Cuomo, none at all. And then you have Zohran Mamdani and winning. I had, you know, I interviewed Zohran last year. He was at the steps. This is before he announced he was running for mayor. I just thought he was interviewing a council person. He was on a hunger strike for a week with some other individuals. And I was asking, why are you on a hunger strike? To stop. There's one we wanted a ceasefire, for a ceasefire. Like I said, I had no idea I was interviewing the future mayor, but that was my introduction to him. Mm-hmm. And what has been, you know, there's been sort of like these two reactions. One is, my goodness, the Islamophobia and the fear of a Muslim New York candidate has got the right wing just really, it's hard to say, like, more vocal than they normally are, but like, people are just admitting their Islamophobia and their racism, and the socialist is going to crush New York City, as if New York City hasn't been getting crushed the last 30 years through capitalism, through catering to billionaires, through the housing market going nuts. I'm a native New Yorker, and I left New York. I'm never going back because I don't want to spend half my income to live in a closet in New York City. And anyone who makes right. less than six figures, and I've never made six figures, that's basically what New York City has been turned into through capitalism. And then on the other hand, you know, we want to put in perspective, what are the limits of his election, both electorally, but also I would say there is a moment here that I feels like something's happening culturally. I mean, meaning this is happening in New York City, right? It's in New York City. This is the highest concentration of Jews, many Jews before him, by the way. And all the Zionist propaganda and all of those stops were thrown at him, and he still won, which is, it's wondering, man, that old playbook of, we just, you have to be more right wing to win an election. That's getting a little thrown out the window in a very tangible way. So there's a lot going on here. And as we move forward, how do you put his election into perspective? How do you see it?
Well, I look at first the fact that ranked choice voting won, I think.
Right. Ranked choice voting won.
Yeah, I think the argument for ranked choice voting for the people, I think that argument has been proven valid now.
Yes.
Which is, of course, exactly why the Democratic Party is going to come out hard against ranked choice voting now.
Right.
You're going to start to see them attack ranked choice voting. They probably already are. I have to look at his politics in particular. Mm-hmm. While he has progressive ideas, and that's great, and I think his defeat of Cuomo is perfect, because, like you said, how that man thought he should run again was, it just blew my mind. He's accused of multiple cases of sexual harassment. Just disgusting.
And the
whole situation with letting elderly people die of COVID in nursing homes during the, oh my gosh, how?
Didn't they get swept under the rug, letting old people die in nursing homes during COVID? How did he escape that? I don't get it.
I did not understand how he escaped it either. This is a weird country with weird people in it. I don't know, Chuck. I really don't. I don't know how people just let this stuff fly. But I'm glad that Mamdani beat out Cuomo, and I'm glad that he did it through ranked choice voting, because the people spoke.
Yeah,
the people spoke resoundingly that they don't want more of the same in this primary. Now, what does this mean as far as policies are concerned? And you know, understanding that he hasn't faced off with Eric Adams yet.
That's right. It's not a done deal.
It's not a done deal. So let's not get ahead of ourselves.
Yeah. And they're going to have billions behind him. Am I right, Jackie?
Yes. And we know that Eric Adams he is who he is. I'm trying not to say words that are going to get us in trouble. He is who he is. He's a cop. He has no morals. He's not a nice person. He doesn't play by the rules. He plays dirty. So I expect the mayoral race between Mamdani and Adams to be ugly and disgusting. You think the Islamophobia is bad now? Wait till it comes out of Eric Adams' mouth.
Oh my goodness.
Because it is. It is. It absolutely is. And a whole lot of black church folks who are older are going to support Eric Adams. Mm. I'm telling you now. I'm sorry to say it. It makes me unhappy. But it's almost a name recognition kind of thing. Yeah. Right? It's like a lot of younger people know who Mamdani is. But a lot of older people don't have as much knowledge of him. Because they don't move in the same circles that younger people do. And you saw how Eric Adams had the support of the black church community.
Yeah.
When the charges against him came down, what did he do? He had a press conference with these church folks comparing himself to Jesus, and they ate it up. Wow. So, yeah, and there was... according to, I guess, the exit polls, there was a pretty good amount of support of the older black vote for Cuomo. It's name recognition.
Did some of that evolve when news came out that basically Trump had compromised him politically and almost made a trade to not charge him in order to comply? Because he also complied with ICE raids. ICE raids came in. And Eric Adams, as well as Kathy Hochul, were willing partners with Kristi Noem in those raids. In fact, Kristi Noem had said Eric Adams has been wonderful to work with. So has any of that changed?
I think among some people, it's not going to change until I think it's with everyone in the case of policy. It doesn't matter until it happens to you.
Right.
You know, it's and I think that's across the board. I think that's most people, particularly a lot of older people across the board of all races, ethnicities, you know, backgrounds, whatever. It doesn't for people in this country. And that's just how America is. Mm. We're very individualistic because that's what this country was. That's the ideology this country created. That, you know, if you make it by yourself. And that's a lie. Yeah. Nobody survives alone. But people are very individualistic. So if other people, even people in their community, people who are like them are suffering because of a bad policy, because of a racist or sexist or homophobic or Islamophobic or ableist politics. Unless it happens to some people, it doesn't matter to them. Yeah. And so I don't think that sentiment is going to change for a lot of people. And that is unfortunate. But we have to understand that this is America. This is not a phenomenon that is unique to this moment. This is how America got to this point. Right. This is how American politics got here. Because people went along with bad policies and bad politics for decades and decades from both parties because the horrible things that were being done didn't happen directly to them or it didn't hurt them hard, you know, bad enough where they could say, oh, this whole system is bad. No. So, you know, I think that this race between Mamdani and Adams is going to expose a lot of really hateful ugliness that we are going to have to contend with. And Islamophobia is one of them. But beyond that, should Mamdani win? And I think there's a real chance that he can.
Right.
Should he win, we also have to measure our expectations with the realities of his policies. Because progressive on some things, though he may be, he's still a member of DSA, which is not socialist, really. He has said that he is an advocate of Nordic socialism, you know, which is democratic socialism and not like,
is that
know,
the Bernie variety?
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. And not Cuban, Venezuelan, you know, not global South socialism.
Hey, can you make that elaborate on what that distinction is?
Well, the distinction is that the socialism practiced in the global South really sticks to the principles of socialism, where the government guarantees the human rights of its citizens. The government guarantees through the redistribution of the resources of the government that goes to provide housing, healthcare, education, and to guarantee the human rights of minority groups in the country. In Nordic societies, you have aspects of socialism where some housing is socialized, but not all. Where you have, you know, education may be socialized up to a certain level, but maybe college education is capitalized. It might be subsidized, but you still may have to pay something. And of course, the issue in Nordic countries is that those populations are mostly European.
Right.
So in the global South, those folks are brown, black, you know, African, indigenous. So we're also talking about the redistribution of land itself. Yeah. In most of the global South socialist countries, the redistribution of land to the original people who were colonized by the Europeans happens in these global South socialist countries. Usually in the Nordic countries, that doesn't happen. So right. It's a big difference in the outcomes for a certain group of people that is not addressed in the Nordic models of democratic socialism that is addressed in the global South models of socialism, and you know, in other countries as well. So,
okay, so from a pragmatic view, let's say he becomes mayor. Some of the things he's talking about are rent freeze. Some of the things he's talking about nationalizing sort of groceries to make them cheaper. Do you think he has a chance to accomplish that?
I think he can accomplish some of the things. I mean, because we know that New York City already has rent control as policy. And from what I understand, the mayor and the city council can expand that or curtail it. That is within their power to do that. I'm not sure how he would accomplish nationalizing or, you know, how you can... because it wouldn't be nationalizing on a state scale, but, right. You know, socializing food. But yeah. I would love to see him try. The thing is, when it comes to foreign policy, that's where he's tricky. Because he has also said Israel has a right to defend itself. And no, they don't.
Has he said that?
Yes, he has.
Defend itself? Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. All right. I missed that one. That is tricky.
Yeah. So, and then I think that was kind of recent. It was because, and remember, he's also running as a Democrat.
That's right.
So if he were running as DSA as an independent, I probably would have a little less criticism on this front. But because he is running as a Democrat, he has to abide by Democratic Party dictates. He has to, or else they will not give him a dime for his campaign and they will turn on him.
Yes, right? And I think
they're
that's what we need to watch.
Already not supporting him that much as it is.
Yeah.
So.
I think we have to watch. I mean, I think since the innocent days of AOC, winning and smiling and everybody happy, there's been a huge evolution with her and her stances since then. So I think that might be the worst case scenario. It's not something you want to take off the table, but it means we want to watch it closely and fight for what we believe is important.
Yeah. And you know, I'm not saying, you know, to dismiss the guy right now.
Sure, of course.
That I'm exactly saying, people, I'm exactly saying, remember AOC.
Yeah.
Don't ever forget what AOC ran as, how she ran, what she said. And then when she won and was fully incorporated into the Democratic Party, what happened? So it's great to be excited now, be enthusiastic about the possibilities,
sure,
but be grounded and rooted in reality and be prepared to challenge him when you must. That's what I have to say.
That part, be prepared to challenge him, you know, when you must. And I think that's the part that people have to be challenged from the left. And like, I think I sometimes use the example of Lyndon Johnson, maybe the last time we've had sort of wholesale Civil Rights Act and decent legislation that would last for decades. He was challenged by the sit-ins. He was challenged by the civil rights movement to the left of him. I mean, let me ask your opinion. If there's no civil rights movement, I'm saying he's even giving the backing before he's having discussions with Dr. King. Do you believe a lot of those laws in the Civil Rights Act happened?
Oh my gosh, no. I mean, it took not just the civil rights movement, but it took the youth within the civil rights movement to move the movement from just, you know, marching and, you know, marching arm in arm and singing to direct action.
Right.
It was direct action of these youth putting their bodies on the line, being attacked by dogs, being beaten by the police, being sprayed with high pressure fire hoses, you know, and having those images broadcast across the country, letting people see what this government is willing to do to children in order to maintain apartheid in this country. That's what forced Lyndon Johnson to sign that legislation. When he challenged Dr. King, okay, this, I know this is the right thing to do, but the will of the people isn't, you know, where you think it is, so you have to make me do it. And the student said, okay.
You have to make me do it. I want to uplift that. Make me do it. Didn't he actually say that?
I do believe he did. Make
Dr.
me do
King,
it.
Make me do it.
Yeah, so, and it's like, wait a minute, you know it's the right thing to do, but I have to force you to do the right thing that you know. So yeah, without the civil rights movement and without the youth power and passion within the civil rights movement that moved it to direct action, there would be no Civil Rights Act. There would be no Housing Rights Act. No, legislation for equality in higher education. None of that. No,
that's right. And you know, I'll use this to take up my time because about one of my favorite civil rights stories, you know, as you know, I like just cover people on the street. But, you know, if I say David Richmond, Franklin McCain, Ezell Blair Jr., Joe McNeil, most people don't know those names. But those are the Greensboro Four. They weren't great orators like Dr. Martin Luther King or even could. They didn't have to be famous or have a gift. They were just four people who said, I'm tired of this. We're going to do a sit-in at Woolworth, and we're tired. And I think in a day, it went from those four to 60 people. And then in 2 days, it was 300 people. And then in a week, it was more than that. And I think by a few days later, we're still looking at 1,400 people. And it just went like wildfire. And one of the reasons that's my favorite story is, similar to a lot of the encampments that exploded last year, is just regular people say, what can I do where I sit in my community? And I think there's probably a reason we don't remember, or the people who aren't highlighted as deeply as heroes who just take action themselves. But I think we're in this space where if there's going to be movement, we need as many Greensboro Four type people as possible.
Yeah, and you know, Chuck, this is why I harp on history so much, brother. This is why, like, what you just did the thing that I love. Like, the struggles that we have been through matter to the struggles we are engaged in now, right? This bringing up the history of how we challenged a brutal system that was crushing us should be front and center in our organizing efforts today. Not so that we capture and copy all of the precise tactics, because I think we're probably beyond sit-ins at this point, but But what you just said about, you know, look, just for young folks who were tired of the status quo and organized themselves to do this sit-in, and what people don't understand about the training that was done for these sit-ins was that these students were trained to do them.
Yeah.
Right? It wasn't just, and this organization, this proves the importance of organization. This wasn't just like folks who were just like, you know what, we're just going to go. No, they had to be trained by SNCC and other organizations like, you know, and CORE and whatnot about what to expect, how to respond, you know, where they would kind of be assaulted the way they were expected to be assaulted when they did the sit-in, so that they would know what to expect, how to respond, not to respond in anger so that it gets worse. They were trained to expect to be arrested. You know, that speaks to the importance of organization.
Yeah. Ella Baker, right? Ella Baker was a big figure in that. And I don't think a lot of people know this, but I think one of the original co-founders of SNCC was Marion Barry, DC's Marion Barry. Mm-hmm. I mean, he didn't stay around too long, but you know, I think that's like a little hidden fact there somewhere.
Yeah, that there are all kinds of really fascinating and really, I think, beneficial to our current organizing efforts, tidbits in our history of struggle that we ignore and we don't take advantage of because we don't know our history. We do not know as much of our history as we should. And I don't think that we can be effective organizers for a better future if we don't even respect and know our history of struggle that got us to this point. We don't know where it is we should be starting from, I think, and how we should be starting from here, because we don't know what was done to get us to this point. And I think we need to do a lot better with that. And I think we would be much more effective in organizing if we did more of that.
I agree. I agree. And I think those are really the stories that we really need to uplift and covering protests. I see these incredible individuals. You know, they don't have titles. They weren't elected. They don't have titles. And you see them in the street. I see them in the street and you interview them and they're amazing. Their conviction is amazing. And it feels like that's really where it starts, where we realize our own power. And as I'm going to segue for a second into sports, but I'm going to keep you on. Bear with me. I'm going to keep you on during the sports part.
Oh,
but
sure.
A lot of our discussion that we've had over the years, Atan, DZ, Dave Zirin, we have this sports discussion anytime an athlete speaks out. Because I'm going to segue into Natasha Cloud, who I love. An athlete speaks out. And there's a part of me that's like, okay, I look at it as a bonus, right? If an athlete speaks out and says the right thing and gives something more attention and a larger platform to speak about these things in new places, in new arenas that where they're ignoring what is going on, whether it is about George Floyd or whether it is about Palestine. I mean, I think that, you know, there's a good thing to that. And at the same time, there's a part of me, there are two things I don't like about it. We always ignore the white athletes. Nobody asks what Tom Brady is saying. And I think that's a racial bias in the sports media community to not hold, you know, white players accountable and to always ask if LeBron said something or not. But the other thing that bothers me is that on some level, I've come to believe a lot of that question is waiting for a savior, whether it's a celebrity savior or a Democratic Party savior, rather than realizing our own power, where we sit, where we live, whether we're a college student or whether in our workplace or wherever we are. And on some level, we're waiting for a celebrity or someone to save us. And sometimes it takes that form when we ask the question over the years. And that is my segue, because I'm trying to find a sports thing, because I know you don't know sports the way you know politics and you know metal. But so we're going to do something easy. We're going to talk about Natasha Cloud, who used to be on our Washington Mystics here. She was my favorite player, and not just because of off the court, but on the court. I just love the way she plays. She now plays with the New York Liberty, and she has been consistently outspoken, whether it was after George Floyd at a protest, holding a sign. And then more recently, last week, she wore a keffiyeh again. She did that last year. She wore a keffiyeh, and she just said she did it at the All-Star game. She's doing it in bigger spaces. And she's been outspoken, and she has no problem saying the word genocide, as she did last year. She said, quote, "There is a genocide happening. People are scared to use that word." This is last year, by the way. "It is what it is. It's a genocide. It's ethnic cleansing. It's intentional. We're not paying attention." That was last year, but it was actually her first comment for 2 days after it was, I think, October 11th, and Yoav Gallant had made his disgusting comments about his intended war crimes of a siege on Gaza, no food, no water. Palestinians are human animals, and we will treat them as such. Just basically openly confessed to a war crime, and she spoke out about it right then. So we have this history here, and you know, so we could talk a little about that, but also we don't hear when the women speak out. We don't really hear as much when the women speak out. They get put on a pedestal. So I want to share some love for Natasha Cloud and get your thoughts.
Yeah, you know, the whole sports and activism thing, I have to keep remembering that, you know, these are still pretty young people. They have come up in a college system that has indoctrinated them to only focus on sports. They have seen the response of the NFL and the NBA and the WNBA to athletes who have stood up against, you know, and spoken out against injustice before. And it absolutely blows my mind when an athlete still says, you know what, I will take whatever comes. Because they've had to, just like regular folks, to get to revolutionary consciousness, they have to undo a lot of backward thinking. But I think athletes have to go through something else, a different kind of gauntlet to be able to get the courage to stand up for what's right. They're putting their paycheck on the line. They're putting, you know, they're putting that, more than likely, their family's financial well-being on the line, because they're probably the person in their family who's holding everybody up, right? So, you know, they're putting the relationships with their teammates on the line, and their mentors and their coaches. And I applaud the few athletes who are making a stand. And I mean, you can count them on one hand. You mentioned one, you know, Chuck. Yeah. The problem is, that is the problem. It's just a few.
That's right.
But
that's,
I also right. think this reflects what America is, right? When you look at the lack of engagement for any of these, in any of these life and death issues that we are all in the middle of, and athletes are saying, most of them are saying nothing, doing nothing. Isn't that a reflection of American society?
Well, it sure is. And I mean, I think I'm going to, to your point, I'm going to segue to Natasha Cloud quote in October 2023. She tweeted this: "As a pro athlete, I will lose deals because of my support of Palestine. I won't get certain endorsement sponsorships because of my stance moving forward. I knowingly take food out of my family's mouths in hopes that another can eat. That another can eat. I choose my moral compass over money." And that deserves to be uplifted. So shout out to Natasha Cloud. We only have a few minutes left, so I have to ask you, Jackie. How can people find you? What are they going to hear about? I think they heard a little bit on Darker Than Blue on Fridays. People want to connect with you. How?
You can listen to me on Darker Than Blue on Fridays at 5 p.m. this Friday. Oh, that's tomorrow. I am not sure what I'm going to be talking about tomorrow. There's so much to choose from. I don't know if it's going to be a light show or a heavy one, but we'll be on the air and we'll be talking about something. But tonight, if you are in the Baltimore area, please go to Red Emma Moore's teach-in or town hall about Dulce imperialism, talking about economic warfare that the U.S. wages on Puerto Rico. So that is another way you can connect with us in the Black Alliance for Peace. Go to our events, or you could go to blackallianceforpeace.com and check out everything we have on that website. And if you are so inclined, you can join us.
Jackie, thank you so much. Everybody, Darker Than Blue, Red Emma's, 6 p.m. tonight, Baltimore. Thank you so much. We at the mafia table next to the kitchen, eating Michelin star.
Wondering how to get WPFW swag in your life? Items that say, I support jazz and justice without saying a word. We've got you covered. Details and browsing at WPFWFM.org. Again, that's WPFWFM.org.
Greetings. This is Papa Wabe inviting you to check out my new showgram, Free Your Mind with Papa Wabe, every Thursday morning from 2 to 5 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. We present a mashup of positive, uplifting music of different genres, mainly roots reggae. We also feature poetry, speeches, artist interviews, and so much more. That's Free Your Mind with Papa Wabe, Thursday mornings, 2 to 5 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, here on WPFW 89.3 FM, making it a better world, one broadcast at a time. Free Your Mind!
The WPFW Local Station Board's Relocation Committee is in the process of re-envisioning what studio space for a progressive, community-based, and community-supported radio station should be in the coming decade or more. We wish to ensure that a new, more permanent home will meet current needs and those less foreseeable in the future. All WPFW stakeholders, listeners, donors, programmers, staff, community activists may share their thoughts and insights about the future space by taking the location survey located on the WPFW homepage. Be creative in your answers. The future belongs to those who dream big. The survey may be found at www.wpfwfm.org. Please submit your answers by June 30th. Thank you for your thoughts and time.
Come on, come on, come on.
To the east, my brother, to the east.
To the east, my brother, to the east. Come on.
Brother to the east.
To the east, my brother, to the east, yeah.
To the east, my brother, to the east.
To the east, my brother, to the east, my brother, to the
education, art, health, music, politics, and all things community.
Yes.
Join me, Ambrose Lane Jr., as we uncover the issues of D.C. communities east of the river on To the East, Mondays at 5 p.m. right here on your station for Jazz and Justice, WPFW 89.3 FM.
On Monday, June 30th, WPFW presents The House That Wanda Built 2025, our annual Pride special programming. From 2 p.m. until midnight, WPFW will broadcast voices from the Inside Out Collective and beyond, discuss issues affecting the LGBTQIA+ community, and present music from the Anthology of Booty and the Ladies' Room, honoring the life and legacy of Washington, D.C.'s beloved Black lesbian activist, Wanda Alston. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
The Birchmere presents Pieces of a Dream, June 27th. Joshua Redman, June 29th. Omar, July 17th. And Hubert Laws, July 20th. Details at birchmere.com.
While Medgar Evers and Patrice Lumumba were not personally acquainted, their lives and struggles are often commemorated together due to the parallels in their commitment to fighting for the self-determination and liberation of African people. WPFW celebrates the centennial of this parallel vision.